Hello, everybody out there in Toronto and beyond, and to all of our international listeners. You are listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Karl Ozhovsky, and I'll be taking you through the next hour or so. On today's program, I'm very happy to have Mr. Bob Timmons in the studio with us today. Bob, you can say hello.
How you doing, Karl?
I'm doing great, thank you. We are going to be speaking with Bob about his tireless amounts and incredible amounts of activism that he's done for marine animals, about his art, about his on-the-streets activism, and all sorts of stuff. But first, we're going to do a little bit of news. This first piece of news coming to us from theindependent.co.uk. I have to say, this article, I don't know what to think of it, and I don't think it's good. I don't usually like to editorialize too much when I read the news, but this article jumped out at me for a lot of different not good reasons. I'll read it and you can draw your own conclusions. The headline is, "I'll have my lobster electrocuted, please." The heartrending sound that a lobster makes as it is boiled alive puts off many a home chef from preparing the dish for a dinner party. But now, anyone can serve up a buttered lobster freshly cooked in their own kitchen, safe in the knowledge that it has been, and I'm going to put this in quotes, humanely killed thanks to a British entrepreneur. Simon Buckhaven has created a machine that takes less than a second to efficiently and, again in quotes, painlessly zap a lobster, crab, or other crustacea to death. The price, at £2,500, British pounds, may deter some, but many an animal lover or restaurant chef will think it is a small price to pay for, again in quotes, a cruelty-free death. Plus, according to the manufacturer, the Crustacestun, as it's called, nice name, also makes the meat taste better. Inside one of the little machines that are going on sale this week, a lobster takes just 0.3 seconds to die, whereas it can live for 3 minutes in boiling water. A crab takes even longer to die as it is boiled to death, up to 4.5 minutes. After several trials here and in the US, Mr. Buckhaven's firm, Studham Technologies in Bedfordshire, has developed a machine that takes 5 seconds to use and meets health and safety and other regulations on both sides of the Atlantic. The entrepreneur is firmly in the yes camp in the old argument about whether lobsters feel pain or not. One side is that their nervous systems are not complex enough to experience what humans would recognize as pain, implying that for a lobster being placed in boiling water would be like being sent gently to sleep in a warm whirlpool bath. Quote, "These are sentient animals who feel pain and distress, and you should not boil them alive or drown them in fresh water or cut them in half while they're alive," he said. A lot of people who love to eat lobster do not like preparing it at home because they have to cook it in boiling water, and restaurants are more frequently hearing questions from customers about how their lobsters will be killed. He added that in one blind test, customers were given lobsters killed in boiling water and lobsters that had died in a Crustacestun, and every participant said they had preferred the meat from the electrocuted animals. Quote, "It was sweeter meat and better consistency," he said. "If you eat an animal which has been under stress before it died, it affects meat quality." However, a planned demonstration of the Crustacestun turned into an unmitigated disaster, not the least for the 1,800 lobsters. This is where it gets very weird. It was a charity event for 600 guests in Tucson, Arizona, whose organizers had consulted the animal welfare group PETA to see if there would be any objection to having lobsters on the menu. PETA said it would be acceptable if the lobsters were killed in the Crustacestun machines rather than being boiled or drowned in fresh water. So, in other words, PETA gave their approval for this. PETA bought two of the machines and paid for Mr. Buckhaven to travel out to demonstrate them. The machines were sent out separately from Mr. Buckhaven. Sadly, the delivery company let them down, and 1,800 lobsters were boiled alive. The machines turned up in Tucson 2 days late. Quote, "We were completely let down and are suing to get the money back," Mr. Buckhaven said. "Unfortunately, I don't think you can sue to get back all of the pain that the 1,800 lobsters felt." That's all the editorializing I'm going to try and do for the day. That's a lot more than usual. The next story coming to us from the Associated Press is also a weird one. Animal to human transplants okayed in Australia. Australia announced Thursday it will lift a 5-year ban on clinical trials of animal-to-human transplantation after the government's top health body determined the risk of transmitting animal viruses to people was low. The decision by the National Health and Medical Research Council means Australia will join a slew of other countries, including the United States and New Zealand, who have conducted trials of xenotransplantation, the transfer of living cells, tissues, or organs from one species to another. Animal-to-human transplants are outlawed in Canada under the Assisted Human Reproduction Act. Xenotransplantation researchers hope the procedure can someday serve as a substitute for human organs, which are in chronic short supply, and help diseases such as diabetes and Parkinson's. The Australian Research Council issued a ban on clinical trials in 2004 after concerns were raised about the risks of transmitting animal viruses, particularly those from pigs to humans. As a side note, pigs are the most often used animals in xenotransplantation. On Thursday, the council said in a statement it was satisfied such a risk was low and that trials should be allowed to proceed once strict regulatory and surveillance frameworks were put in place. The World Health Organization has urged nations to establish regulatory control and surveillance before allowing any transplants to take place. Quote, after careful consideration, the council is of the view that, although there is a wide range of community views on the topic, xenotransplantation research was acceptable in Australia, and there are, when there are robust regulations in place. The move was welcomed by Australian biotech company, surprise, surprise, Living Cell Technologies, which is conducting trial in New Zealand that implants cells from newborn piglets into human volunteers as an experimental treatment for their diabetes. The cells produce pig insulin, which is very similar to human insulin, and has the same effect of lowering blood sugar. Living Cell Technologies hopes the cells may be able to delay the effects of type 1 diabetes, including blindness, premature coronary illness, and limb amputation caused by poor circulation. The next story, we're going to move right along. The next story, and the last story coming to us from CBC News, and this is a good one. I think last week I promised that this week was going to be all good news on animal voices, and I realized that I'm going back on my promise, but this is a piece of good news. One piece of good news that I found this week. Good animal news, hard to come by. CBC News, the headline is, Outside Experts to Probe Calgary Zoo, says the president. A commission of experts will be asked to conduct a comprehensive review of all animal care practices and policies at the Calgary Zoo, the embattled facility's president announced Saturday. Quote, on Monday morning, I will be contacting the presidents of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums in Washington, D.C., and the Canadian Association of Zoos and Aquariums in Ottawa, Dr. Clément Lanthier announced during a news conference. The two organizations are, quote, the accrediting bodies that set the standards of care for zoos and aquariums in Canada, the United States, and other Western Hemisphere countries, Lanthier told reporters. The AZA also provides leadership, guidance, and training to professionals in more than 200 institutions that include the largest and most highly regarded facilities on this continent, such as the San Diego Zoo, Bronx Zoo, and Disney's Animal Kingdom. Quote, I will be asking the two organizations to appoint a joint panel of highly qualified individuals, completely independent of the Calgary Zoo, to conduct a thorough review of all aspects of animal care at our institution, including staff experience, training, veterinary care, policy and procedure, and any other facet of our animal care operation they believe to be relevant to the inquiry. The objective of the review is threefold. 1. To commission an expert assessment of the quality of the facility's animal care, that will provide an authoritative, unbiased, and knowledgeable perspective on the standards currently in place and whether any improvements can be made. 2. To maintain the strong support the zoo has enjoyed from the community and to reassure Calgarians that they can continue to have confidence in the institution. And 3. To recognize the incredible work done by so many of the zoo's staff and volunteers, which has been the target of what Lanthier termed much unfair criticism. When this review is complete, Lanthier said, a summary of its findings and all of the recommendations arising from it will be made available to Calgarians. Animal rights groups have questioned the zoo's practices after the deaths of several animals in the past few years, including a baby elephant, a hippo, a wild goat, 4 gorillas, and, if you remember from last year, the death of more than 40 stingrays that mysteriously died in an aquarium there. On Friday, a zoo staffer was suspended for 2 days without pay after causing the death of a female capybara. The large South American rodent was crushed in a hydraulic door and suffered fatal injuries while being moved from one enclosure to another. Lanthier said the capybara that died last week was actually the second to meet its end at the zoo. Another died after quarantine shortly after the three arrived at the zoo in July when it was attacked by another capybara and didn't survive surgery. ZooCheck Canada and the Calgary Animal Rights Coalition called for an external probe of the zoo following the rodent's death. In announcing the commission, Lanthier said he, quote, always subscribed to the notion that even a world-class organization can become better if it is prepared to accept and act upon constructive criticism. However, he added, quote, much of what I have seen and heard over the past 2 years has been far from constructive. I worry that some of our critics do not want to see this zoo improved. They want to see it closed. And he says, that is not what Calgary wants, nor, of course, what our 200 employees, 600 volunteers, 80,000 members, and 1.2 million visitors every year want. And what the animals want seems to be outside of what he's considering. So that's kind of a bit of good news. My only concern with that story is that the AZA, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, is an organization that's essentially put in charge of making sure that zoos keep going. What they'll find, I think, is somewhat questionable, although I do, on one level, applaud the Calgary Zoo for at least opening up its door to a third party and letting them in to give some criticism, which is probably long overdue. That, my friends, is the news. And you're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. On today's program, we have Bob Timmons. Bob is the artist for the ocean, and through his powerful awareness art exposes stories of worldwide marine animal decline and abuse and critical issues of ocean health. He leads, organizes, and documents street demonstrations, marches, and grassroots protests, and through multimedia brings these events to a wider global audience. He is a fearless vocal advocate for animals everywhere. Bob also combines the arts and sciences in his advocacy. As an environmental sciences graduate, he integrates knowledge and passion in his paintings, writings, campaigns, and public outreach. And I have to say, Bob, you are one of the people that has really jumped on the AR scene in Toronto in the last few years. And I think all of us have been, frankly, have been surprised and taken off guard by the amount of energy and enthusiasm that you bring to your work. So, Bob, thank you, and welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Carl.
Not a problem.
I'm still suffering from the 1,800 lobsters that have been killed.
Yeah, it's a weird story. You know, this tension between quote-unquote humane death, as if death can ever be humane. Maybe it can be, I don't know. I've never died, so I'm not sure how humane it could possibly be. And the wanting animals to feel less pain, but at the same time also not wanting to condone their being eaten for pleasure is another thing. I mean, I actually have never eaten lobster in my life, mostly due to finances and in the past 10 years due to not having any desire to eat lobster. But I can imagine that being eaten is probably not the nicest way to go.
I would agree with you there.
Bob, I wanted to start by just asking a bit about your background and how you got involved with animal issues. You were mentioning to me before we came on the air that you kind of burst onto the scene, and some people were like, where did this guy come from? And so where did you come from and how did you get here?
Well, yeah, that is a very good question, because a lot of people that I am networked with worldwide as well as local actually just know about me just showing up and taking leadership in certain areas and organizing a lot of things. Well, going back to about March of 2007, I came down to Toronto just to push my art. That was my main objective, to come to Toronto, to a big city, that to be a part of an art community. And as I did so, I ended up seeing a movie called Shark Water from a local producer here, Rob Stewart. Mm-hmm. And that movie just totally hit me deep and started some stuff moving. Mm-hmm. And I was so inspired that I sent out an email to all the people I was friends with at that moment. Of course, we're not animal rights people, and you know, thought of me as some energetic lunatic.
Right.
You know, so of course I ignore all that stuff, as I do today. I just keep focusing on my passion. I keep pushing forward. So along came Scarborough Arts Council here in just outside of Toronto. They put out a request for artists in regards to the environment. Instantly, I thought this was my window to paint for the sharks. This was a way that I felt I could put out a great message. So I started painting. I finished the painting up in January of 2008. And I named this painting, One Shark is Worth a Million. Now, of course, with millions dying a year, I thought that was the most appropriate name. Mm-hmm. So the best thing about this Scarborough Arts Council was that for the first time it was going to be put into a Chinese embassy around Toronto here, and it was going to be around Chinese New Year's. So I thought, wow, this is like great. If I get in here, being a juried entrance, I thought it was going to hit all the right people that I wanted to expose this to. Unfortunately, I was denied, and you know, the painting did not make it to this exhibit. But of course, I didn't stop there. Mm-hmm. I you know, went around that wall and decided to start networking. A gentleman named Duncan has a StopSharkFinning.com, I believe. Well, he posted it on his website under his news, and right there, I'm like, wow, you know what? It's time to use the internet here. It's time to start networking and getting this out. So. I started doing that, and as I was doing that, I was learning about a lot of people that were doing it. And I started to grab onto those people and start networking with those people. And they're such the most compassionate people out there. Sadly, it's only 10% of the population of the world, which is the population that's alive. You know, the 90% of this population on this planet is actually just surviving, in my eyes, now that I've, you know, jumped over. So as I was doing that and pushing the information on the sharks, I started following the Sea Shepherd. And they, at that moment, were heading down to the Antarctic to protect the whales. 1,000 whales that the Japanese want to kill every year under the name of research, which is outrageous to me. And before I can do any painting, I have to do research on it. So I have to develop on what I have to expose and how to get the story out. So I end up doing a painting on the whales to put that story out because I thought that was something much needed. So it's not that I was aiming to be a part of the ocean per se. It was just this is how it comfortably flowed, and I just allow it to go the way it goes. So I continued on, and I followed the Sea Shepherd from there over to the east coast of Canada, which a lot of controversy occurred at this moment. It was in regards to the mass slaughter of 300,000 harp seals. And being a Canadian, I felt this was a great painting to put out and to expose it as a Canadian and as a, someone who's against it. I am from the East Coast. I'm from Cape Breton. And just because I'm from the East Coast doesn't necessarily mean I have to support this fashion. So I end up painting that one as well. And what I put a seal on top of a splattered, blood-splattered Canadian leaf to expose the country of concern. And a lot has happened since then. Within that painting itself, it also spoke about how the Sea Shepherd were off the coast in the international waters trying to expose this inhumane act to the world. Then, of course, our Coast Guard rammed them, arrested them, towed the Farley Mowat into Cape Breton, per se, where I am from, actually 10 minutes from where this boat is currently sitting. So from there, it was all about just seeing more horrific videos and articles. And because I have a connection with worldwide compassionate people, I get this news from everywhere. And I do not take it to the point that it destroys me. There's a lot of people that I am aware that come into this movement, and it's hard to, I wouldn't say be desensitized by it, but because a lot of people, they're so passionate about it that they take it in so much that it just wrecks them, and they're out of commission for a while before they can get back into it. For some reason, I'm different. I take it and I use it. I take that energy, and that's when I pick up the brush and I decide to paint. And I meditate, in a sense. As I paint, that's my meditation, and that's my relaxation time. And I do my best to put out the information that we really, really need to put out. And I believe a lot of people like visuals. So to be put into a painting, I can hit a large amount of people that would not even normally even come close to any demonstrations, protests, to even listen to programs like this. So I find it to be a good tool in that fashion to help educate And children love pictures. Mm-hmm. I have an 8-year-old daughter, which, if I can quickly say, happy birthday to her. She just turned 8 years old yesterday. She's been involved in a lot of activism here in Toronto as well. She's a good critic of mine, you know.
I find the kid. I think I've heard that from a lot of artists and musicians that their kids are often their best critics. Like, no, Dad, that riff sucks, or I don't like this painting, or I want to actually go back maybe a little bit to ask you, what was your life like before you got into animal issues, and what was it that you saw, if you can recall a particular scene or something about the Sharkwater movie, like what was it that really hit home for you? You mentioned that movie as like a pivotal moment. So what was it in that movie that really turned things around for you?
Well, the reason I went to that movie was a friend of mine that I was with, she loves sharks. And, you know, we went there thinking that it was going to be this amazing movie on the beauty of sharks and the beauty of the ocean.
Which it is in a way.
It is in a way, but it also is bringing in the truth. And that's what really hit me. I love reality. I want to know what's happening. I don't want to be blindfolded anymore. You know, we got too much of it in the media. We got too much of it with our government. We need to be conscious consumers. We need to be exposed, empowered. And that, you know, just seeing the horror within that movie was just outrageous. And my daughter has watched this movie a few times. Being young, everybody thinks, oh, no, no, you know, my child's too young to watch that. Mm-hmm. Well, when are they old enough? Mm-hmm. You know, I understand there are certain things that I will not allow my child to watch until she's older, but that one's very low-key in the point that it actually puts out a great message, mm-hmm. and I think that's why it's doing successful.
Maybe let's rewind as well. You mentioned, and a big reason that I brought you on the show is to talk about your painting. So I was wondering if maybe you could tell us about painting. How did you get into it? How long have you been doing art? Do you do other art? And why do you paint as opposed to, let's say, doing photography or, I don't know, woodcuts or something like that?
Well, I have been into the art world, you know, my whole life. I've just loved creating. You know, for example, high school, like I tell you, every semester I had an art class. And I... You know, sadly, I'm more into the art history now, but sadly back then, all I wanted was art. If there was, you know, I wouldn't go to the advanced class because I didn't want to learn about someone else's art. Right. I just wanted to create. But as I continued on, I did veer off and went to college for different reasons, and I came back because I didn't want to be, you know, the poor man artist.
Right.
I grew up poor, so I wanted to get out of that direction and not stay within it. So... As I continued on, I do a lot of other things in art. That is, I just anything I can pick up, anything I can learn. I've done tattooing to airbrushing. I'm currently learning a bit about graffiti because that's an amazing street message. Mm-hmm. And, of course, dealing with animals, I want to do anything I can to put a message out. So I have a friend here in Toronto that's into the hip-hop scene that's exposed me to that energy. So I'm learning through her how to do graffiti, and of course I'm going to start doing some tagging somewhere. Right?
Well, maybe we don't need to get too into that stuff. We can
do it in a legal sure. fashion, of course. but I've only been painting since approximately 2004. A lady I met in Newmarket just said, you know, she saw my art and said, "Here's a canvas. Here's my brushes. Paint." Mm-hmm. And from then on, it's just evolved amazingly. And like I said, it wasn't until the Sharkwater that it evolved even further. And to go back to your question, which I know it was a long, drawn-out answer, ARC 2 ended up grabbing on to me because I wanted to find a way to come out publicly. I didn't know. I didn't know how I can go about setting up demos or protests and I felt like my message needed to go further than the paintings. Mm-hmm. And that's when I became part of the Animal Issues publicly. And ARC 2, Animal Rights Collective here in Toronto, which is an amazing organization, brought me on under their wing and supported all my radical views and thoughts. And I tell you, they didn't turn down almost anything, really, mm-hmm. that I brought to the table. They were so willing. I love those guys. Like, they, mm-hmm. you know, I'm there to support them for the rest of my life. But then it continued on, and I met all the other organizations, and that's when I came on the scene. Mm-hmm. And that's when everybody's like, okay, you know. Well, I heard this months later that, right. you know, a lot of people had some iffies about me, which, you know, it's flattering, you know, because I did have a lot of energy, and I still do have a lot of energy. And, you know, as long as there's still issues with animals, it's going to keep pumping my blood filled with this energy to expose the issues.
Bob, we need to take a very short break, and then we will be back. You are listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. If you have any questions or comments about this show or any of our other programs, you can drop us a line, and I highly encourage you to do so. Love mail, hate mail, we'll take it all. animalvoices@gmail.com. Welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. And we are back with Bob Timmons, Artist for the Ocean. Welcome back to the program.
Welcome back.
Bob, I wanted to ask you, because we were talking before the break about these images and things that you've seen, and I think that that's an idea that a lot of people who are into animal issues can relate to, this idea that once you've seen something and once you've been exposed to something that's horrified you or made you feel sad, profoundly sad or something like that, that you can't not do something. But I'm wondering how, if you can maybe describe a bit of the process of how you go from being horrified or outraged or disgusted by something that you've seen to synthesizing that into what becomes your paintings.
Well, it's kind of tough at times to explain exactly how I go through the process, because sometimes I don't even know how I go through the process. When I do see something, for an example, when I did my Taiji Bay dolphin painting, which is it's about the dolphins that go, they get lured into a cove, and I seen video of this, and I have never ever seen blood in the ocean as I have in this cove. And the video that I seen, I kept putting it off as I was doing other paintings, and I kept saying, I gotta paint this message. And the horror that's going on and the concealment that's happening really, really got to me. And I thought, you know, that's what I don't like. I don't like when things are hidden. And when it comes to the Taiji Bay issue, everything's been hidden for years. And I'm happy to hear that the cove that came out this year is really, really hitting it hard. Oceanic Defense is a part of this issue. That's they're part of the grassroots that are happening over there that are involved in the daily events. And I just feel like, you know, I just grab those images. I start, you know, get images within my head. And I feel, okay, this is what I got to do. I got to add this. I got to add that. All the important aspects to tell the story. And that painting alone probably took about 90 hours to get fully done and complete.
And how big is it?
4 out of the 5 paintings are 48 by 40.
48 by 40. So you're looking at, what, 4 feet by... Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, they're quite large. I just had a showing of them, actually just finished up a week ago. And that was the first showing. And I call that, I call these paintings horrifically beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit about that. What is that? What does horrifically beautiful mean?
Well, you know, when you think of art, everybody thinks of beautiful. They think of beauty. They want to see these wonderful pictures and they want to feel happy. And my paintings are very much like that. Now, the horror part, of course, is what it's about. And I've done the Riverdale Art Walk here in Toronto a couple years in a row. And these paintings aren't for sale because I have other means for them. But when I'm in the Riverdale Art Walk in my tent, I have all my paintings. Well, I'll put one of these in there. And those paintings draw people in to ask questions because, like I said, they are beautiful, if I may say so.
Sure. I would also say they're beautiful. I've seen quite a few of them on display in different places, and I highly encourage anyone to check them out wherever you can see them, and especially on your website, which maybe you can give now.
It's Bob Timmons, Timmons, T-I-M-M-O-N-S, .org.
Okay. So you're saying on the Riverdale Art Walk, you display all your paintings of varying subject matter, but it's these paintings that draw people in.
Yeah, I only bring one because I'm pretty well doing the setup myself.
Okay.
And being so large, you know,
right.
I just want to bring one. And that does draw in people, people that are concerned or interested, or it brings in children. And the best thing is the children know more about the issues at hand than the adults. And a lot of the times the adults just, you know, push it off as if it's just nothing. And while I'm sitting there and I'm talking to them, I totally inspire them to keep going. They tell me so many great things, and I tell the parents, you know, wow, your child's very in tune to what's happening in today, in the moment, because there's so much happening, especially with the ocean, and that's why I direct my attention in that fashion.
How do you know when one of your paintings is finished? It sounds like you do quite a bit of conceptualizing beforehand. So it sounds like you're not painting in like some kind of improvisational way. You're thinking things out very much ahead of time. So you have a pretty good idea, I think, of what your painting's at least supposed to look like before you start.
It evolves quite a bit within the time frame. You do have a first image, and then, of course, by the end, it's like totally different. Mm-hmm. But it's still putting out the message that you want. But how do I know that it's finished? Honestly, it's when I sign it, and that forces me not to touch it again. I've made my unwritten law that as soon as I sign something, do not go back. I've done it once, and I destroyed the painting, so I will not do that.
Okay. You talk about your paintings as awareness art. Could you describe to me what you mean by that?
Well, it's bringing the awareness of the marine animal at hand currently. Like, I have done 5 marine animals, all with horrific stories that need to be told. And that is the awareness that I felt right from the beginning, from the shark one, that gives me the passion to keep continuing to do and to put out these stories and to have people exposed to them. And hopefully some people will, you know, everybody gets triggered in a different manner.
Mm-hmm.
I very much have met a lot of people now, and we've all come onto this side, as I say at times, you know,
sure,
outside of the box, looking in at the bubble that we just left. And we've all been triggered in a different way. And I'm hoping maybe someday my art may trigger somebody, because that would be amazing to me. That would be, you know.
Have you received much feedback from people?
Well, I have amongst the AR group, of course.
Sure.
They love it. But actually, to bring up my gallery, I'm with the Hangman Gallery here, the Artist Network. And recently, after the showing I just had, it's awakened them to want to be a voice. They want to use what they have, their skills and professionalism that they have within their gallery. And they asked me to help them with this, to be a voice. You know, they want to do a showing with me and maybe some other animal rights groups or any animal painters, in a sense, that have a message to put out. And they want to expose that and put it to the media. You know, they want to be a part of that, and they want to start having a voice amongst themselves. And I thought that was just terrific that I brought that out.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask this question anyway, but it's interesting that you bring up the gallery, because I'm thinking, and I know someone who runs a gallery, and there's always this tension between doing something for the art and also, in the case of political art, doing something for a cause and paying the rent, to be blunt.
Rent, yes.
You know, you mentioned that you don't sell the awareness pieces that you do.
That's right.
So I imagine that by not selling it, you are actually allowing more people to see them, because it's not like one person buys it, puts it in their living room, and then 10 people see it at a dinner party, maybe. But I imagine for a gallery like the Hangman Gallery, it's a pretty bold move for them to say, hey, can we do a showing of your work? Like, for example, the Horrifically Beautiful exhibit that you did. It's a bold move for them to say, can we do this? And for you to also say, oh, but they're not for sale.
Well,
don't think you're going to make any commission.
Honestly, a lot of people go, what do you mean your art's not for sale? And I'm like, well, luckily I have a job, so I don't need the money. But I see these pieces as something greater than, like you say, hanging on someone's living room wall and only seeing the people that show up in that living room.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be why I'm creating a book on these paintings, and each painting is going to be a chapter, and it's going to talk about these issues.
Can you tell us a bit about the book? What's the timeline for it? Maybe who's putting it out? If you're allowed to divulge that information yet, or anything you can tell us about it.
I have 3 fascinating individuals that are editing the book right now. Okay. Three beautiful ladies. You know, they're one's vegan and two are vegetarians. So like, they really match what I'm all about. The timeline on this book is, I'm hoping for February. Between February and April, you know, you can't put too much strain on yourself. I like things going organically and flow naturally. So I don't want to put any stress on the editors.
Fair enough. But, you want to let them do their work.
Yeah, I think I'm going to be doing a self-publish. I'm doing as much as I can without putting any money into it, per se. I'm going to learn how to put it together myself. I have my brother-in-law, who's with iImage Photography. He's my photographer who's putting out everything properly, and he's going to help me design it. We got a short run place in Brantford, Ontario here that will put out the book cheaply in a small run, so, because I can't put out 1,000 books, you know.
Sure. We were talking about before the program about what the book's going to contain. Maybe you could tell our listeners about that. It's not just, and not to put down, books of just paintings, but it's not simply a book of paintings.
No, exactly. These paintings aren't just paintings either. These paintings speak a message that needs to be spoken to the voiceless animals that we are trying to protect. Now, each painting, of course, has a reason for the painting, and that story will be told in each chapter in regards to the one painting. And what I'm going to do below that, I'm going to explain how I put that story together in my painting. And then I believe we're going to, you know, we're working on it, but I think we're going to put a summary of what has happened after I have done this painting, because these paintings took about 2 years to fully complete, five of them. And there's a lot happened within 2 years, because I've only been involved in AR for 2 years since the paintings, mm-hmm. and only like probably a year and a half actively. And within that time period, so much has happened. And I'd like to put that out so people realize that positive things are going on, mm-hmm. you know, because it's hard to focus on one thing and say, well, nothing's happened here. Like, it's been 2 months and there's still nothing.
Right.
And that stresses out a lot of people, and they instantly say, I'm done. I'm done with this. But that's why I want to put out this positive message, to expose it. And, you know, hopefully that will draw people in as well. And I'm going to be, you know, I'm a lot about organizations and helping any way I can. So this book's going to have a lot of postings of organizations. And I'm sure when I do finish it, I'll have some sort of donation going to certain organizations, or a random one every month, or whatever I do. I'm not sure how I'm going to put that out yet, but I am all about helping.
Mm-hmm. In addition to all of the painting that you do and your intense focus on art, you've also done a lot, actually I would probably say a startling amount of on-the-streets activism. What's the difference to you between the sort of art as activism that you do, these awareness paintings, as you call them, and the more, I don't know what to call it, traditional kind of activism that groups like ARC2 might engage in? How do you see those two fitting together?
Well, to me, myself, they mm-hmm. fit in, you know, the same, because that's, it's from me that's doing it all. But looking at it, I see many levels of activism, and the street activism is, of course, one level, which within that there's many different levels as well, because you can expose the horrors, or you can actually, you know, sit there and actually come into a conversation of just naturally talking to someone. It all depends on the individual when it comes to that. I've been a part of, you know, exposing. I've been exposed in my underwear for activism, you know, a couple times in the extreme
weather. I've seen
weathers.
Photos of it.
You know, like in the winter, there we are, and then in the summer, there we are doing a meat tray. And but the thing is, when we do that, it's to say that, yeah, we can endure this for an hour, but mm-hmm. an animal has to endure this their whole life. Mm-hmm. What does it matter to us? You know, we. The media loves it, mm-hmm. you know, and that's a lot of the times we need to get a hold of the media, and that's mm-hmm. where the street activism really helps. Mm-hmm. Because when you get a hold of the media, it's not that we're aiming to do that at times, but then we're a part of their circulation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, instead of just hooking up with the people that are passing us by, maybe 100 to 1,000 people, now we're exposed to 60,000 to 100,000 people. Mm-hmm. And being an artist, and seeing what has been going on, I'd like to bring in some creativity into this and mix it up, because sometimes things are the same and we don't want the same, because mm-hmm. the same has been going on for 20 years. Mm-hmm. We need to change it up. We need to add in things. We need to really push different issues and different ways of exposing this.
Maybe this is a good time to talk about the announcement that you wanted to make on the show. You're wearing an Oceanic Defense t-shirt in the studio for all our listeners at home. It's a very nice t-shirt. I'd actually like one myself. Oceanicdefense.org is the website for the organization. And Bob, you have been appointed to the board of advisors for the organization. Can you tell us a bit about Oceanic Defense and what your role is going to be?
Oceanic Defense is one amazing group that I've been involved with since I did a shark march earlier this year, and I met the founder, Jeff Shaw, or I spoke with him. I only recently met him in the last few weeks when I was doing some traveling. This organization, I've followed it for the last year and watched it grow immensely, and it's all about empowering the individual through education to say that, you know, everybody can be that leader. Be with their everyday life, they can really help the oceans itself. And you know, they're willing to educate and back up anybody who's interested in changing their lives in a positive direction. My role is pretty well as an advisor. I'm going to be helping with if they need any AR work, leadership, organizational skills within the grassroots area. That's the stuff I can bring to the table, which funny enough, I see that I've done quite a bit of it without even realizing.
You've talked so far quite a bit about, you know, seeing images and seeing videos and reading articles and that sort of thing. But I think it's important for our listeners to know that this, you're not just someone who's sat around on the internet or gone to demonstrations and that sort of thing and learned in kind of in a bubble. You've just come back from Florida. You've done quite a bit of traveling to go to places of concern. Maybe tell us about your recent trip to Florida and about Lolita.
Well, what I decided when I started to focus on ocean itself, I spontaneously, which I do a lot, decided to do some trips. And what I did was I went down to the west coast of California, where I met Jeff Shaw from Oceanic Defense and his wife, Danielle. And they took me out in the ocean. They showed me what was happening in that area. So I got to, you know, really experience the West Coast. I flew over to Australia, met up with a lot of amazing people. I stayed with my friend Lindsay, who is from Newcastle, Australia there. And she exposed me to so much on the Golden Coast. Also, there's a lady down there that's doing amazing work, Surf Watch, who's trying to remove shark nets. So, yeah, I was being exposed to all this ocean life. Then I came back, and I ended up doing a trip to Florida, hanging around with Oceanic Defense's director for research and biology, and she brought me to, she exposed me to so much in 8 days that I was there, from the shark lemon issues that are currently going on and trying to protect the shark lemons down in Florida, and she's involved in that, speaking at the commissions and stuff. And just to say, for the lemon sharks, there's a positive note that they're really they're pushing to have it done, and hopefully in February the lemon sharks will be protected in the Florida waters. But I went down and I saw a beautiful orca. Orca is my spiritual animal. I feel I'm very attracted to that animal. I love them. And it was so sad to go into the Seaquarium in Miami, who I met the organizer of this event that's trying to retire Lolita. Her name is Shelby Proey, and you can see her at SaveLolita.com. What we're trying to do is expose the issues. This beautiful orca was captured, I believe she was at the age of 6 years old, with four other members of her family, which have all died except for her. And this is back in 1970. So as of next year, this poor animal has been in captivity, forced to entertain for the last 40 years.
Wow.
She's 22 feet long in 20 foot deep water. Or sorry, I think it's 35 feet in the deepest area. Okay. But anyways, the whole
at any rate, it's quite small.
It's the smallest pool that an orca is in within captivity. and it's leaking everywhere. Like, I exposed this. I went down and documented this with a video camera and did some interviews with Shelby, because that is something that I love doing. I love documenting to get this message out, because people need to see that it is real. And this poor orca, you know, and the dolphins, now lives with two dolphins in this small space. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, if we can do anything there, they've already had a place set up in Washington, D.C. to bring her, to allow her to be an orca, teach her how to eat fish again. And if she's willing, expose her to her pod and hopefully introduce her back into her pod. Mm-hmm.
And that would depend, of course, on the pod accepting her back.
The pod accepting her back, and if she's willing. If not, they're willing to feed her for the rest of her life there in a natural, huge space.
Right. Bob, we only have about 5 minutes left on the program. I wanted to, you know, maybe I'm saving the hard ball for last, and it's a bit of a devil's advocate question, but I wanna ask you, why focus on marine animals? Why is that important for you? Why not? I imagine some people listening are thinking, well, why don't you do a painting on veal calves? Or why don't you do a painting on mink?
Well, of course, they're all important.
Sure. I'm not in any way suggesting that you don't think they are.
Oh, I know. where my street activist is a part of all that, where my art is, it is focused on marine animals. When you're in the art world, you need to focus on something to become a professional artist. People want to see you as a specific realm. So mine is the ocean. And the reason I've chosen the ocean is, first off, it came naturally. As I was seeing issues in regards to coming in with the shark for my research and finding other issues within the ocean. And recently I listened to a podcast of Alana Mitchell, which is an author here in Toronto, who put out a book called Seasick. And this just adds to why I've focused on the ocean, because the ocean is the life support system of the planet. Mm. And we really need to be exposed to what's happening there. And she brought up some really great points. She brought up ocean symptoms. And, you know, that's acidification, coral reef decline, dead zones, overfishing, and debris. You know, we got a lot of plastic out there that needs to be dealt with. So in regards to, you know, being a part of the ocean, and it's so much where life is. There's so much in there, and no one realizes. And we don't even know about the ocean itself.
Bob, we have about 3 minutes left in the program. I wanted to make sure that I could turn it over to you if you had any final thoughts that you wanted to share with the listeners. I really want to make sure that you can give a description of your website. It's quite extensive, and I want to make sure that people do check it out. So why don't you give us a description of that site, and if you like, maybe a bit more information about oceanic defense and how people can get involved in some of the issues that you've been talking about.
Well, first off, for Oceanic Defense, I really like to put out their website. It's oceanicdefense.org, and that's defense with an S. Really, if you go there, you will learn tons of stuff. Now, in regards to my website, I do separate all the awareness paintings, and I do, I've done my best to just put a small blurb of what's happening and why I painted for that animal. In time, I'll have something about the book on there as well. Please join my email list so you'll know a lot more of what's happening. I am quite busy. I do my best to expose everybody to what's happening in regards to my art world, as well as you can join my fan page. The reason I went to a fan page is because I have almost 5,000 people on my regular profile, which is just a social network. And so I've put a lot of info into my fan page, which you can find as Bob Timmons. There I go. It only took me to the end.
If you search for Bob Timmons on Facebook,
endangered marine animal artist. Yep. There we go. You will find my fan page, which you can. I have a ton of documented videos that I've been involved with. I do my best to keep the knowledge that I've learned updated, so to keep you all informed of what's happening with the ocean, because that site is strictly for the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Bob, I want to thank you so much for being on the program, and especially I'd like to thank you for the kind of activism you do, not only because I appreciate artistic activism, because I'm an artist myself, but also because it's refreshing to see someone who, first of all, has as much energy as you do. It's a rarity, and I hope that you take care of yourself and that you find ways to be able to sustain it, because it's a rarity. But you have been gone for a little while, and seems like you've got a good rhythm. And I also want to just say thanks for not doing lazy activism. And what I mean by that is, I think there can be a tendency, once people feel like they've reached a certain degree of awareness, that they know all there is to know, and that there's not really anything more to learn. But the way you're talking, and if anyone visits your site or visits your Facebook fan page, it's very clear that you're someone who is always wanting to learn more, and is not content to just sit back and go, you know what, I know about this issue already, and here's what needs to happen. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Carl.
Not a problem. And thank you for being on the program. And there's a phone call. It's not for me, I don't think. At any rate, that is the end of our program. You've been listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM, and we've been speaking with Bob Timmons. Bob is the artist for The Ocean, and you can check out all of his work on his website, www.bobtimmons.org. That is the end of the program. If you have any questions or comments about this show or any of our other programs, do check us out online. You can check out more info about the program at www.animalvoices.ca, and you can always drop us a line with critiques or thumbs ups to animalvoices@gmail.com.